This is the Urban Political,
the podcast on urban theory, research, and activism.
So I'm very happy that we managed to get you around the virtual table here of the Urban Political podcast. We're going to talk about the sort of urban landscapes of care and control, as we call it very broadly, in three cities today, in Bogota, in Colombia, in Berlin, in Germany, and in Santiago de Chile, in Chile, with Mario, we practiced my Spanish, and I still can't do it. Mario José Álvarez Rivudela, Felipe Link, Hannah Schilling, and Ina Margis today. So may I give you the possibility to maybe say in a few sentences what you think about the question of how the pandemic has affected state interventions in health in your city, and what comes to your mind thinking about the perspective from your city in terms of the care arrangements or different arrangements of care that have been developed in neighborhoods in Bogota, Mario, as I know that that is one of the things that you've been working on.
Yeah, I'm very pleased to be here and to learn from your cities and participate in the podcast. I'm going to talk about health, but in a broad sense. And I like the name of the call of this podcast, the control and care, because when I was thinking about what happened with Bogota welfare system, say, or welfare regime during the pandemic, I could think of the left and right hands of the state, and that meaning the care hand and the police hand or repression hand. And many things happen in Bogota and in the country, like poverty skyrocketed, maternity mortality, adolescent pregnancy, adolescents abuse. Most of those pregnancies came from rapes, from family members during lockdown. So many things, terrible things happened. Of course, like in many other cities, deaths are not equally distributed by social class. The poor died in a higher rate. But to kind of put order to the interventions, I would say that there's something very interesting in terms of care and something very interesting and worrisome in terms of repression, or yeah, in terms of repression. In terms of care, I think it's very interesting that one important intervention was created during the pandemic, and those are the care blocks, which are an initiative that started before the pandemic, but was implemented during the pandemic, and has to do, it's a local initiative initiated by the women's secretary of local government. And it has to do with putting in very busy blocks in deprived neighborhoods, a block of care with services both for those who need care and especially for the women that take care. And that's a very interesting initiative that gives classes, well, from yoga classes to high school classes, while you have your kids or your the people that you have to care for there, you can take classes as a caregiver. So it's a very interesting initiative. There's other services as well, and it's expanding. I think the pandemic gave the local government the leverage to expand that initiative, that at the beginning it was only in two places, and now it's projected for about 50 other places, 50 more care blocks, they call it. So that's, I think, very interesting. And on the other hand, the repression hand of the state. So during the pandemic and during the lockdown, there were several strikes and street demonstrations that were victims of great police repression. Many people died, And this is a very repressive police. It's not new, but the discourse of repression in many ways was shaped by the lockdown rhetoric. In particular, the first police killing was because the police killed one guy that violated the lockdown, and someone filmed the police brutality. And then the man died, and he was, "Please, I have to go out." He was in his motorbike, and the police, they beat him to death. And that was filmed. So people got a lot of rage. They went out to the streets. And according to a UN investigation, 11 people were killed by the police in those protests against police brutality. And the mayor of the city recognized her guilt in that, her responsibility on that. So a lot of interesting things happened, both in the care side and in the more repressive or control side.
Felipe, that difference between care on the one hand and control or violence from the side of the state on the other hand, I think that is, shouldn't be too difficult for you to jump in on that from Santiago de Chile, right?
Yes. Well, also, thank you very much for this invitation and to participate in this podcast. Yes, these two ways of the pandemic situation in general, you know, the care or the health measures or control and the social control is also very strong in Santiago. And also because, as we talked before, in Santiago, it was totally overlapped with the social movements and social protests from October 2019. So, in March of 2020, we have these lockdowns and the whole the spread of the pandemic of the COVID. So the both are very overlapped, and in terms of social control, there was still the feeling from the riots, the social riots. So we lost a lot of trust in the institutional structures, not only the governments, but also the politicians, the police, the whole institutional structure was very affected by the protest, the social protest in 2019. So it affected to the health measures that came in March of the next year. So I think that was a very particular point in Santiago, because we have to deal with this, with these two dimensions of the crisis. But then I think in this specific issue of the social control policies, it was also a very individual responsibility oriented. No? There were individual responsibility oriented policies. And that was not a good thing, because it was more overlapped with the social crisis. No? So the repression was oriented to particular people who didn't respect the lockdowns or the other policies or measures in order to deal with the pandemic situation. So, and the people who can't deal with these restrictions were called as obstinate people. No? And this is very strange, because it was a whole situation in the city where people have to go out to work or to take care of different people, and they were called obstinate people. So the first step was very difficult in these terms, because it was still with the memories of the social protest and a lot of repression, not very violent, but very violent in a symbolic way. The lockdown was a very hard lockdown in Santiago, a very long one and also very strict. We have to go home at 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock, or something like that, until the next day for weeks and months. So it was a very strange thing. Also, we have the memory from the dictatorship and the lockdown. The restriction of circulation and to go out in the public spaces was a lot of years ago. So this dimension of the pandemic situation was very hard in these terms. But on the other hand, it seems to be a good thing, and the health measures and the vaccination process then 1 year ago, later now, I don't remember exactly, but I don't know, 6 months or 1 year later, we started with this whole organization process for the vaccination. The other thing that I think it was a particular thing from Santiago, maybe in other cities too, but it was not a good thing for the whole, for the control of the whole situation. In addition to this individual responsibility, was the scale or the national scale of the whole of the whole policies. We didn't have a local or specific territorial local measures, so all the policies were adopted for the central government for the whole country, and that was a bad thing because they didn't put in value the local organizations, the local confidence, the local networks of the people who can take care of each other in this situation. Also, the health system was very general in these terms, so the municipalities also can take some measures in order to deal with this in the local scale. So I think it's important, this distinction between the social control with more or less violent processes and the health situation, in particular with these different measures in terms of different scales and the local organization of the people in the neighborhoods and in the municipalities. Scale in some term.
Thank you, Felipe. So I think that both those two elements, now that where the control becomes care, where the care becomes control, and that question of scale, of various scale policies being imposed on various scales or developed on various scales, have also been issues that maybe Berlin has been situated from. Has been situated in, rather. Hannah, would you like to maybe take some time to come in from the perspective of Berlin on what you heard and connect it to some of your own observations?
Of course. Thank you for inviting me to participate in the podcast. And it's just fascinating to listen to both of you and to bring this into perspective to the Berlin situation. I think one element that is probably, I would say, different to Bogota, and I don't know Santiago de Chile, maybe not, but you spoke a lot about control in a violent way, like state control in terms of physical violence, and I think in the care and control continuum for the Berlin case, I would say we more experienced symbolic violence or the violence of maybe standardized categorizations and top-down approach of thinking care through the lens of the state in terms of categories like the family should now take care of the children, or that it's more the way we thought how care is a private issue, and so in that sense I think we could also discuss what when you ask, for example, Talia, when care turns into control. I think it is exactly tricky because for the Berlin case, it's not that that suddenly the state came out with a police force and tried to enforce new rules to the population, but the form of control was much more subtle in the way they interfered in the everyday life of residents, I would say. Maybe Nina, you also then want to add your opinion on this question. And I also was struck by your example, Macho, about this collective care blocks, because I think that shows that we also could discuss in what way care is sort of a collective endeavor or a collective not task, but something that has to bundle people and resources to maybe provide for others. And I think in Germany it was much about the trope of solidarity, like that was the narrative that that was the major narrative to push or to incite people to follow the rules, so to say, but it was not a solidarity that appealed to certain care collectives or maybe blocks in the city, but more it was about individual discipline, like to care for oneself or to care for others through disciplining yourselves by distance or by staying at home, etc. So I think in that sense it could be interesting to discuss with you how you experienced in what form the care was featured. I don't know if you understand what I mean. And I think in terms of scale, it's also interesting that the Berlin case, Germany is a federal state, has a federal system. And in that sense, I think we can maybe also discuss how that differs, or how in that sense, the policies and the presence of the state was different in each of our cities. But I also must say that even if it was decided maybe in different federal states, there were different measures, and for Berlin there was a particular set of rules or policies. I think from our research on with residents and professionals that really tried to continue their work in the neighborhoods with residents, it still felt that it was a top-down policy. And in that way, I don't know, we could discuss if the federal system changed in any ways the way residents on the local everyday, in the everyday and in their interactions with each other experienced that this more localized perspective it still was a policy that didn't respect their specific local living conditions.
I think you're making an interesting point there, Hannah, that exactly what Marshall was describing in terms of now how it's a collective process of care in the middle of the pandemic. It very much feels like that wasn't so much what the Berlin case was about, and even maybe the in contrast, right? Like there was an active attempt to stop all forms of collective behavior in public space everywhere. And I know that you and Nina, you've been working on this research project during the pandemic that looked at community workers, basically, right? That were engaged with residents and looked at how they managed to do their work. Nina, maybe you want to say a few things about, describe a few things very directly from that case, and then we go back to the more conceptual level, maybe.
Yes, of course. And thanks for having me here as well. So Hannah already mentioned that we were doing this this project during the pandemic, and it was basically to learn more about the experiences of people, frontline workers, that were doing social work, and to find out how they adapted to these new measures introduced in the context of the pandemic, and also how their work routines and their work with their clients were affected by this. So it was like different youth and migrant organizations, but also local authorities, specifically those that deal with children and family related challenges. And we also participated in various activities in the neighborhood organizations. So for example, when they did handicrafts, or when they offered space to sit outside, or offered cups of tea. So we were taking part in these activities and talking to these people. And what became quite clear from this, and this connects where with what you just said, Talia, the question where care becomes control. Because these social workers or frontline workers in the community organizations, they felt very much caught in between different or two different logics. On the one hand, these state logics of health prevention, all the measures that now came from this top down and they had to implement in their work. And on the other hand, these everyday logics, their routines and the way they normally organize their work, also their pedagogical work with children and young people, for instance. So these two different ways of doing their work and organizing their routines, they clashed and they felt in between these two and had to adapt new roles they weren't, they didn't know before. So these tasks of explaining the new measures, of disciplining their clients, even of controlling their clients, of wearing a mask or of having their vaccination passport and of keeping the distance, which clashed often with their role of like being there to support them, to care for them, or even to hug them when they were like in worries or when they were crying. So these two like ways of working clashed and were very they're very present in the way they described how their work changed during the pandemic, and how this also affected then the work with the clients, the relationships of trust they can build or which then did not exist any longer. So it really had like a concrete impact on their work.
So I've heard the word trust in both your explanation, Nina, of those mechanisms of everyday routines on the one hand and the institutional processes on the other. Marja, would you say that you, if you thought about what you've seen in the pandemic through the lens of trust, would you say that that community or care blocks that you've been describing, is that, has that generated a new sense of, I'm being carefully saying not saying trust, but because I think I heard in Philippa's words that there is a bit of a crisis of trust due to the way that the control has been implemented. Maybe a crisis is not my word. And I can hear in Nina's and Hannah's case, because I know it quite well, obviously, that because I'm from Berlin myself, that this is a thing that we, that there's a lot of talk about this. Does that play any role in Bogota? How is trust seen in the context of the pandemic?
Well, I think it's a complicated question, because it's trust about whom, no? And definitely institutional trust decreased, especially with the police. I mean, the police is going under reform. I heard what Felipe said about the memories of the dictatorship. Colombia didn't have a dictatorship, unlike many other countries in Latin America, but had a war. So this is a police prepared for war. And now with powers to put people inside their houses in a country that has 50% informality. So people cannot stay in their homes, and the police is repressing them for care, for doing what they have to do, which is care for their survival. So in many ways, institutional trust decreases, especially with the police. Then, of course, these innovations are very important, but their impact, which I haven't measured the impact yet. I would really like to do a project evaluating how this is working. It's very interesting, but I don't, many things happened, because at the same time that you get this care blocks implemented, you have an increase in poverty, an increase in informality. So it's many forces are eroding the trust with the state. I did do an evaluation of another interesting policy, which was a cash transfer, an unconditional cash transfer to compensate for the regressiveness of the of a tax, of the consumption tax, to poor families. And people really didn't know why they were receiving that. They didn't have an idea that they were receiving it because they were overpaying for the consumption tax, but they thought that the government was giving them that because of the pandemic. You have a lot of interventions getting into homes, but they are all insufficient to satisfy the needs for people. Maybe, and I was thinking about what Nina and Hannah were saying, is that the level, I mean, the point of departure is very important here. So of course, in Colombia, you have much more room to innovate in terms of policies and do things that have a real impact. But at the same time, there's 50 million people here, immigration from Venezuela coming, and I didn't speak about that in the first, but that's also an urban challenge coming to the cities. So it's very difficult to do things that have an impact in an economy that's in recession. In terms of what you can do from the state spending, government spending is still very low. Yet I do think it would be very interesting to measure this or observe it or the specific or follow this specific impact of the blocks of care, because that has to have an impact, has an impact on the, you see it in the life of these women that go there. I would love to follow up on that intervention, but don't have clear answers right now about the impact.
So that seems to address both the sort of interpersonal trust of people working out trust relationships of caring relationships on their everyday levels or in their everyday logics, as well as the sort of institutional trust that I think you addressed very well. Philippe, in your earlier comment, I think you were talking more about the institutional trust, right? The sort of trust in the police, trust in the state. I know you've been doing a lot of work during the pandemic. We've all been doing all sorts of work during the pandemic, but from the research that you've been doing in that time, is that something you've been looking at?
I think it's important, this distinction between the institutional trust and the everyday life trust from people each other in the neighborhoods or in the social contact. The institutional, I think, we talk about it, and it have to do with this overlapping situation with the social movements. For example, the first lockdown was interpreted as a measure of social control because of the social riots, not as a health thing. No, the first one in March, it was the how the people has interpreted it was as a social control measure. Now they don't want people in the streets, so we implemented the first lockdown. Then I think it was a little bit different because the pandemic situation was in all the steps, and we know a little bit more about it. And so the institutional trust is, I think, another thing very clear in Santiago because of this social tension that we had from 2019. And in terms of a more local scale, or what I meant about scale and the relations in neighborhoods, we also observed a lot of increase of social relations in general terms. For example, we saw a revival of a thing that we didn't saw since the 80s. I'm not sure about the translation, but I think it could be the common pot or something like that. And maybe Majo can help me. Ollas comunes, no? Where people...
Soup kitchens.
Okay, sorry about my translation. But this kind of things were very common in the 80s to deal with poverty and things like that. And we didn't see that kind of organization. But now, in the first year of the pandemic context, it was very common to see that in the neighborhoods. So, this kind of things, and also the care networks between neighbors and people in the local scale of the city was also a very new thing, because in Santiago, the last years, I think it was a very individual city in terms of this kind of organizations, social organizations, local organizations. We don't have a lot of this kind of relations in the city, but with the pandemic, I think it increased a lot. And also because the policies and the lockdown in specific was a very urban problem, no? Also, for example, because the housing conditions of the population in Santiago. Santiago is a very segregated city, so it's not the same thing to deal with lockdown in the upper middle classes districts than in the poor areas of the city, and to deal with 15 square meters house where they live a whole family the whole day in this lockdown situation. So I think it was a double sense of social relations. On the one hand, we observed an increase of relations, social trust, organizations, this kind of collaboration in the neighborhoods, but on the other hand, it was also an issue of tension because of this conviviality in a reduced space of housing and also of violent neighborhoods and things like that in a very segregated city. So I think it has two ways, these new patterns of social contacts or social conviviality in this period of time.
It's very interesting that you bring up that point of soup kitchen being back during the pandemic, which is the opposite of the Berlin situation where such things were closed down. I'm going to maybe go back to Hannah for a minute, and I don't know if Hannah, if you I seem to recall a story about the and food activity for youth that was closed down at a youth center in the research project. Maybe you can talk about that, because I think that is exactly the opposite. It's maybe not exactly the opposite, but it is a bit of the opposite movement of or social development of what some of Philippe was describing. And maybe you can link that to explore a little bit about your own work, which is a lot on on in your comparative work between Abidjan and Berlin, which we can't talk about today extensively, but at least I know from your work that you've been very involved in discussions about households and community in terms of household and networks and that debate, what the collective is and what care is and what household is. Could you try and link these things somehow?
Yeah, I'm really glad that you bring up this this vignette from the empirical fieldwork we did together with Nina, because I remember as well the situation where we were sitting with social workers and professionals, and they were telling about their situation with their how they can still provide for their clients, for their youth, and they said that one aspect that doesn't come up in the media and in the public discussion is that if we close down the activities that maybe, I don't know, young people can come by accidentally, or that they can, I don't know, just come to the youth club without any pre-registration and all this, like, then they don't get only access to the official program, but also all kinds of side resources. I think that is what you meant, Taya. Maybe you can also correct me. But I think what is important to think of is that institutions or localities, foci of interactions, like where activities take place, they bring resources to others that are not intended, but that maybe you can get a free meal or something. And then when all these activities close down, these families that maybe have really limited resources cannot use all these maybe public or semi-public spaces in the city to provide for themselves. And I think that brings me, or that can be the link also to the question, what are the sites that we need to look at if we think about care and provision and livelihood in the city, and also where the limits of the household are, if you think of household as householding, as providing for dependent children and relatives. And it's maybe not only the place of residence, but also all kinds of other networks and sites where people make a living in the city and care for themselves and others. And in that sense, this is what I said before about this limitations in the like the policies, they didn't acknowledge this complexity of urban life, but instead kind of called for people to stay at home and with this call they kind of reinforced a standard and in that sense a category of control that is the heteronormative idea of the small family living in one place and in a fixed unit of residence. And I think that is a problem we need to address in order to understand also how cities work and how inequalities get reproduced. And I think during Corona, during the COVID policies, or the COVID policies have made this, like brought this to the fore. Or no, how can I say this? Like they made this more clear, even because their answer to the pandemic was not to actually reinforce these ideas about city life as maybe lived by a minority of people who have their own, I don't know, property with a huge garden and can live like inward orientated only on by themselves. But that's like a minority, and the majority needs all these in between spaces of the city. And in my research in Abidjan, or in comparison, or where I did comparative work of the making of livelihood in Abidjan and in Berlin, I make this argument that we need to to think of the way people make their living in cities. I mean, that's not a new argument, but I think it's new in the way we need to think about this also in contexts like Berlin. And I think the pandemic made this even more clear that we, in order to understand what are the effects of such policies, we need to think of economic, of household and provision and economic lives in a different way.
Yeah, and I'm already seeing that we need like 5 hours of podcast time, because I'm having new questions coming up all the time, because now I'm reminded of something that Felipe, that you've been telling me about at some other moment, where we were talking about COVID, where we were right in the middle of it. And I think you were explaining how some of the controls took place in the major areas, like the middle class central, not major, but the central areas of the city. And in some neighborhoods, the control wasn't so harsh because there was no way of doing it, because the amount of people living on informality was so huge that you couldn't force them. Am I correct?
Yes, it was very different in these different parts of the city. Yeah. The idea was to deal with the whole population in the same terms, but in everyday lives is what it was impossible, you know. I think the our government has insisted in this individual responsibility that I mentioned, and also in this obstination of the population. You know? Mm-hmm. That was not a good form of deal with it, because all of the people understood that some people have to or need to go out to work, or have to go out into public spaces to have a little time of rest in terms of this housing condition. So it was impossible to have the same restrictions maybe for the whole city, considering these special differences or housing difference or socioeconomic differences. Also, for example, the technologies or the access to internet or the possibility to work at home, now that is very different in Santiago. It's very limited to a part of the city and part of the population. We also observed finally that the people didn't accomplish this measures. No, it was impossible. Not because they didn't want it, because they can't stay at home, or they can't stop working because they have to get money for their families. So and we saw that, and I think the government never understood the thing in a good way in terms of designed all the kinds of policies, or to make this different, to differentiate it in terms of different communities or municipalities or local governments or things like that.
It seems that the massiveness of not being able to do that I think, Majo, you've also described for Bogota, that massive scale Berlin did not have. So how people that worked informally, or people without paperwork, as of people sans papier, so how people that don't have legal status in the city and were completely dependent on these informal ways of, and I know we have to think about the use of the word informal and what informality is, and there is a lot of informal in the formal, and this would be a podcast in itself, so let's just sort of pragmatically skip over this discussion for now. But that seems to be something that there's a lot to explore of what happened to work that was not done according to visible formal labor positions in the city of Berlin, And it could well be that the absence of the total absence of facilities like soup kitchen and things like that during the pandemic has actually affected people on a individual level much more harshly than we know so far. Nina, I wanted to turn to you and ask you to maybe reflect on what we've had. Sort of, we had a few questions and we've derivated from those questions, but because we very much talked about the first period of the pandemic, and would you say that the atmosphere, or as the sociology of the emotions is your specialty, that the emotions around the pandemic, or the sort of public observations of what this solidarity of taking care of yourself so you can take care of others, staying at home is a form of care, and not shaking hands, not hugging, that was very much the first phase. And I think there was a sense of maybe that there was that type of solidarity. How has that developed over the time? And what is that now, if you look at that today?
I think there was, maybe we can take this back to the question also of trust we were earlier talking on, and because so far we were mainly talking about this interpersonal trust, like not trusting maybe people at the beginning because we did not know in the city whether they were had COVID or not, so we were not getting close to these people. Or I remember there was a situation in the park where a child fell from a bicycle and nobody helped because the people around didn't know whether the child maybe had COVID or not. So something before was no problem. Everybody would like go there and help. Nobody did. So this mistrust in the beginning in the city towards strangers, this was, I think, very much felt. And I think, but this had changed over the time because COVID is now so long with us, and so. But this is something I would say we could observe in the beginning when we talk about this interpersonal trust. And then we had we mentioned also in the institutional trust, and I think what's also interesting there is that it's not only about people trusting the institutions or not trusting them, but also how the people that work for these institutions were creating trust or trust relations to people in the city before, and how, and there we come back to the emotions, how they were trying to do this during the pandemic, because building trust depends a lot on emotion work, like comforting people when they're in situations of worries or sadness, but also encouraging people and giving them hope. This is something we also saw in our project. This was very difficult during the lockdown or the pandemic because of all these social distancing, but also the mistrust, like who is maybe carrying COVID and who is not, and how to behave. What we learned during this research project was that social workers like really had a challenge of how to do their work in terms of comforting people, encouraging people when they were sitting in the room with them, but in 2 meters away, they couldn't get close to them and hug them. They had to wear the masks where they didn't really see whether the people were smiling or not. So this really posed a challenge to them. And also when their work shifted from the physical space in the city to the digital space, we haven't talked so much now, but when all the work they were doing was on Zoom, like we are doing now, how can you do like social work and emotion work when you maybe have a black screen in front of you, or where you cannot look people in the eyes and they know that they're addressed when we talk to you? So all these different ways of dealing with people and working with people impacted a lot how the emotions in the city in general developed, and also how trust was affected throughout the lockdowns and the pandemic.
Majo, I thought I saw you move in.
Yeah, I was just thinking about what Dina was saying, and I don't have numbers, just impressions about this, but the number of people begging in the streets has increased enormously in Bogota in the last 2-3 years. You see a lot of children and a lot of adults begging. Many are from Venezuela. And many people are living in the streets. So the level of indifference, I think the social level of indifference has increased in many ways, because people, because of fear, you could also see a lot of, in these cities, in third world cities, you get indifferent to that with time, and you close your window in your car, or you just say, I'm sorry, I don't have today, because you cannot be giving away 10 times in the same walk, which is what people, I mean, you find people, and that has increased. And that fact, with school lockdowns for more than, school closed for a year and a half. So I was just thinking about a personal experience with, there's in my own neighborhood, there's a mom with two kids that come from Buenaventura, a very poor city in the Pacific coast. And over this year and a half, they've been begging in my neighborhood every day. And when, like 2 years ago, 1 year and a half ago, one day I found them in the park and I invited the kids to play soccer with my kid. Over the passing of this last year, these kids are very different now. I mean, they haven't been in school, they probably don't have a house, they are begging. You can see their eyes are different than they were a year and a half ago. And that's terrible, because if you lock schools down for a year and a half, what's the level of inequality? I mean, they have to beg, they have to be in the street, they have to be with their mom, the mom has to beg. I mean, the level of disadvantage of these families just increases and increases with the pandemic. And on the other hand, people are becoming more indifferent to their suffering.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that, Majo. When we were talking about the story about the institution that Hannah was saying that was providing the youth workers facilities, I think one of the other things that youth workers were saying was that some of the kids that came there to a special cooking class, they had a class how to cook, and the youth came there to cook, but they didn't really come there to cook, they came there to eat. So with the closure of the class, the big question was, what happened to these kids? And where do they eat now? Which doesn't have that kind of scale that you're describing, but I think in the intensity of the unequal experience of the pandemic is massive. And is in sharp contrast to this idea of individual responsibility, and everybody as an individual is involved in this pandemic, and we're all exposed to the same kind of conditions and dangers, and I think we've been spending the last 2 years talking about how this is not true, but the consequences, the long-term consequences of that "this is not true" statement, of the observation that the impact of the COVID measurements has tremendously different impact. This is not a very good sentence. So In the last 2 years, we have been talking about this, and we have been saying this will increase inequalities. And I think now we're at the point that you see the consequences of that statement, that what we knew from the very beginning when they closed the schools, how this was going to have an unequal impact on kids in cities and on families in cities. I think we're now seeing the consequences of that. Hannah, do you want to kill on this?
Just wanted to add one personal thought that is like not based on any research, but I have the impression that from the position that I'm living in Berlin, this what you all just described is even I think more or sharpening and more problematic or dangerous, as on the other side I observe colleagues, friends, etc., people in my bubble, so to say, like getting comfortable with the situation by often of like living quite separate from any public sphere or any encounters with different people. So it's like you can live at home in front of your computer, and you don't need to engage as much as you needed before. And I think for some of the urban residents, it's quite comfortable. And that I think brings to the table the question, how can we create the conviviality that you spoke about, Felipe, or the form of publicness that you also write about often, Talia? How can we, like, what should we do in order to recreate public life in the city, at least in Berlin? I have the impression from that's not based on any research, but I think it's an important point to add, how in the long time of the COVID situation, that's now 2 years, you can, like, it's a new routine of like, you don't need to go out. You share your insights with your best friends, but you are not in a form of collective conviviality that is necessary to be even aware of the differences in the city, of the unequalness of cities. It's a personal thought that I had.
I guess it's not just a personal thought, right? I think we've all done types of research that show that there's a retreat of middle classes, an inward oriented of certain parts of the population, that is a form of privatization that COVID has fostered, that COVID has, or the COVID regulations have made more possible to do. And now we don't need to have gated communities in terms of, like, we used to conceptualize them, because they've taken on new forms with people living their lives from a digital perspective. And I wonder, at the moment that we speak, and maybe this is not good to bring it up because it will expand, and I think we have to, you can think about the last thing you want to say, maybe on this question of what could we imagine that needs to be done with the public to change that. But it's the moment that we're speaking is actually the third day now of, I think it's the third day of trains of the Deutsche Bahn arriving at our central station here in Berlin with refugees from the Ukraine. So there's, and because it's so quickly, there is no way of organizing this in a sort of bureaucratic German regulated way. So what people have been asked to do is come with a sign that says how many places they have for people to sleep, and come to the station and show the sign. And then there's volunteers that try to locate, oh, she can have three people, here's a woman with two kids, and kind of match the people. And it's interesting that I saw a picture of these signs, and a lot of these signs say two places or three places for two weeks. And this is the minimum. They said you can come and host people for at least 2 weeks. But I'm very, very wondering about this outpour of sudden moment of empathy and solidarity that hasn't, the date that's stamped on it says it's 2 weeks. So I wonder whether, in my positive moments, I think this is the outburst of solidarity that COVID has prevented us from sharing. And at my more dark moments, I think this is the feel good motive of, you know, sheltering someone for 2 weeks, but after 2 weeks, we'll see how that. So I think that is related to the very basic question of what is the public, what is the togetherness, of what is the cohesion, what is the urban fabric? Is that neighborhoods where people have care blocks, and is that the right way to go? Should we try to think of care and care arrangement on that very, very small level? Or are the questions that Filippa has also brought up, and Hannah as well, and I'm sure Mario has thought about this too, of scale, and can we do these things on the neighborhood level, or is that the forms of segregation and inequality in resources? Are we reinforcing these when we stick to the neighborhood level? And if it's not going to be the neighborhood level, are we going to be back with CIMO and say, well, it's the only thing that's possible because everything else is so immense and so big and so large that we have to develop an attitude of blasé and care is not possible? Your last statements on this, please. Philippe, you have your mic off, so you can go first. I mean, you have your mic on, sorry.
Yes. I think that inequalities is the big issue, I think, that this that we have to deal with in all the crises. I also think, which will be the next crisis in the next months, because in Santiago we have to deal with three or now in the last semesters in the university time. So which will be the next one that we have to deal with? And inequality appears as the common base of these different crises that we have to confront. So the last years was COVID and this segregation, and I think it's very interesting the both sides that Majo and Hannah put there in the conversation. For on the one hand, the lot of people in the streets in Santiago is the same thing because of the migration, but also because of the economic crisis that was also here with the COVID. But on the other hand, this middle class or professionals that are very very satisfied with this new everyday life. You know, they stay at home, they can work, they have digital connectivity, they can ask for delivery and all his needs, they can cover it with a computer. So I think this difference between this both sides of the social structure, to say something like that, it's increasing, and it's a bad thing in terms of inequality. And you can see that in the streets, you know, in the everyday life in the city, you can see that a lot of delivery guys in motorcycles, less people in the street, less difference in the streets, less old people in the streets, less children in the streets. So the landscape, at least in some places, at the city center or in public spaces, I think is changing. And the future of that, I'm not sure how it will be at the end. But I think there are some things that are more stable. You know, this new difference between people working at home and people living in the streets in these two points of the range, I think is more stable than we want to. And also, I think about Talia said in terms of this solidarity, this temporary solidarity. I have the memory about our natural disasters. We have a lot of, for example, earthquakes. You know? The last one was in 2010. And after the earthquakes of 2010, it was an explosion of solidarity. You know? So, but it was not a long-term one. So, 2 years after that, we came back to the normal times. You know? I think with this crisis, maybe it's the same thing. I don't know, but it's difficult to imagine a new community and a new form, a stable form of solidarity. I'm not sure about that. I think there are a lot of good initiatives in the last years, but I think they are not a long-term
I think two years of solidarity with the people that are arriving at the rail station should really be enough. 2 weeks seems a bit on the short side, really. But who knows? Majo?
I was thinking about the 2 weeks of solidarity, and they are still personal ways of dealing with it, which ties with what Hannah was saying about the individualized way that the care took place in Berlin. I don't know, I think the state has a huge role there. Of course, the people have to contribute to that, but the state has to engage with the solidarity, is the main responsible of the solidarity. And at the beginning of the pandemic, we did another podcast about policies, and I was very hopeful about recreating the social contract in Colombia. And for the first time, the idea of a basic income was coming through. Many political parties were saying that they were indeed a lot of cash transfers, a lot of money going to cash transfers, because the state realized these people were not going to have any income security or food security. But then my initial hope faded, because I don't see great changes in terms of state welfare in these poor countries or middle income countries. I don't see a change towards basic services. Of course, there's a lot of innovation, and I don't want to erase them with this overall narrative, pessimistic narrative. We have to pay attention to those initiatives, but I don't see a new social contract coming through.
Maybe that's where we should stop. We don't see any new social contract come through yet. Nina, Hannah, brief last words, last thoughts?
Maybe I can just quickly say, because your question was also about whether we should forget the neighborhood level at all and not pay attention anymore to this, or just look at the global transnational things that are going on. And I think we should not, or we should stay also, or not forget the neighborhood level, because I think this is where people still have the feeling that they can still change something, even if the state, for instance, is not dealing with the solidarity or the social contract as we hope for. But this is where we can do like small practices, small things, even when they're like in gray areas and bypassing the rules. But this is where like care or solidarity is still practiced. And I think this is what we shouldn't forget about this.
Hannah, you brought up the last.
Yeah, I just.
So you can now wrap all up and.
No, I think I'm a bit. I'm not feeling so comfortable with this either, or with this question. If we should forget the neighborhood, I think what we should do is to look at forms of collective life. I think that is an expression that I think borrow from Abdelmalik Simon, but I think we should see where it happens. And that's also referring to your project, Talia, that you are doing with the SFB about what is the neighborhood actually. I think we cannot say we should look at the neighborhood or at the individual, because what is the neighborhood after all? So we should look at the ways in which people create forms of collective life, and that could be transnational. So maybe we should think of all the I think we during the field where we, or you, Talia, I don't know, talked about people who are actually traveling between Lebanon and Berlin and bring medication, and that was blocked during the Corona times or during the COVID policies because the borders were closed. So in that sense, we need to look at how people live and organize care and organize their livelihoods, and that could be at different levels. And I think I think for us as sociologists or as urban researchers, it could mean that we I don't know, take that we should be aware of not falling into the trap of looking at individuals, but, you know, looking at how they are all, we are all dependent on each other. And even if someone tells you, I lived at home all the time during Corona, there must be some forms of, I don't know, some forms of interaction. And that is something that we, I think, should be aware of when we want to understand how society works.
Yeah, thank you, Hannah. I think that's very well put. And I also think that it wasn't so much, it was a provocation to say, should we forget about the neighborhood level? Because the way it can impose, it can stimulate, it can enforce forms of inequalities because people live, depending on where they are in the city. Now, segregation automatically means that if you do everything on the neighborhood level, that there are certain resources that never leave that neighborhood. But that doesn't mean that I think that's exactly the thing. You have to look where is collective life really practiced and how can we build on that? And if that collective life means that my softball team partner rents a car to drive to Ukraine because he's from there and we all organize goods for him to take there, then that is a transnational form and a society-based, also softball club based form that has no neighborhood connection, that would never work if he was going to do that in the neighborhood with the same level of speed and intensity that it did because we are the team, right? So that I'm sure he got very many other people involved in it and not just the team, but the fact that the team was a team and the team has a WhatsApp group that produces this exchange of I'm donating this in a matter of minutes. And I think that was in my neighborhood, that would never happen because there isn't that type of, so I think that's a very important point to always think about this, the block of care and then to refuse to buy into the idea that this block has to be a block that I can actually walk. Whereas in other contexts, I think that you were describing, Mario, it's a precondition that it's a block that you can walk because the care situations in which you're in mean that you can't be further connected than in the local space that you have, where you have to be with your child or you have to be with other people that you're caring for. This is very interesting. Thank you very much. I think the podcast hosts, whatever mediators, can't say that the conversation was interesting. So, but I'm hoping that the audience of the podcast is also going to find this as interesting as I found it. Thank you very much for this input today. And we hope to have you back on another occasion soon.
Thanks to you for listening.
For more information, visit our website, urbanpolitical.podigy.io.
Please subscribe and follow us on Twitter